This episode of the Packet Pushers Weekly Show is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/weeklyshow and use the code weeklyshow30. Welcome to the Packet Pushers Weekly Show, another design and build edition. And in this show, we will talk through a business problem and solution that led our guest to, in this case, installing Cisco Dynamic Fabric Automation. Now, you've heard of DFA on Packet Pushers before. If you look back in the archives, Cisco sponsored shows 207 and 233 to talk about the product. So if you're looking for the Cisco point of view on DFA, you can give those shows a listen. In this show, yeah, we'll talk about DFA, but we're going to talk about a lot of other things along the way. So strap in. I am your regular show co-host, Ethan Banks, and with me, Greg Farrow, whose dulcet Australian voice, featuring just a hint of posh London accent, will grace your ears. And our guest today is Tom Grisham, a grizzled veteran of the networking wars. And Tom, welcome to Packet Pushers, and please introduce yourself to the audience.
Hi, I'm Tom Grisham. Thank you for having me today. I just want to say I'm addicted to networking, where too much would never be enough. I love that. So I've been doing networking for quite a while now. A little while ago, and I think it was 1997, I got a CCIE number, 1767. So I've been operating, deploying networks, emerging things like frame relay, ATM lane, VoIP. And these days I play around with SDN-WAN and some data center orchestration type things.
1767, you said, was your IE number?
Yeah.
You went way back before it was even cool to be an IE. You were on that, huh?
It took me a while to get out there. Yeah, so 763rd person, they started numbering at 1,024, I think. Yeah, back in the day, you had to do your lab with real equipment and cable it up and then run around the front of the cabinet and make it work. It was a lot of fun.
With real equipment. Man, you are old. You have a gray beard and stuff.
What's left of it? Grizzled, cranky old network guy.
What he's actually got is marks on his head where he's been beaten with sticks and face-palmed himself so often.
Well, I heard ATM lane. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to interpret that.
I'm an expert in that. If anybody there's a whole episode on the bus.
Oh, boy.
I did just enough of ATM lane to just realize just how bad some things really were.
Well, Tom, in the intro, I was talking about, Cisco DFA, which is certainly a part of what we're going to talk about here. But let's back away from that specific thing for a moment and really set this up with you had a business problem to solve that you ended up solving by building out an Ethernet fabric. Can you set this up for us by explaining what the business situation was that sent you down the road of this project?
So my client company I work for had a view of IT should not get in the way of what the business is doing. It should support and enable their function. And they had a lot of pride in that and had a long-running bit of success of doing things. You might say the mantra was more, better, faster, with fewer people, quicker, those types of things. They really took it to heart. So at the point Cisco's DFA, and I believe they call it programmable fabric now, so first,
several name changes over the years, really.
that's a part of the fun of this is as much the technology as keeping track of the name changes of the same thing you learned last week. But we were at a spot where we had a data center room that had outgrown itself. It was time to remodel that, get a facelift, an upgrade, new fresh paint, update the power and things like that. And so that project had been slated for some time and it was known it was going to happen. So now we hit the period where this is the next project. And so it's kind of a speeds and feeds. And this was a couple years ago. And we said, okay, well, we're getting a lot of 10 gig connected servers, right? And the last greatest data center we built at the time it came along, it was for high speed 1 gig aggregation. So it was the traditional Cisco FEX connected to the Nexus 5500 class layer 2 switch, connected to the Nexus 7000.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it was beautiful. Perfect design for all of our 1 gig aggregation. And then our server teams started buying 10 gig servers.
So 10 gig LOMs and with copper? I'm just curious, were they tended to be more copper or more fiber?
We tended to go with fiber. It's less space. It's easier to wire. you spend a fortune more in SFPs and things like that. So it's good for Cisco. It's good for the fiber companies. It's good for the facility room.
But slamming those into a 10 gig FEX was not working.
There are problems you learn along the way, like, oops, the 10 gig uplink off the FEX really is only 10 gig. But if you have a couple of them, then there's a pinning, you know, which sessions and ports go onto which uplink.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot of things that are there in the specs if you read them back when you bought it. But with 1 gig aggregation, it was a good design, and it was the speeds and feeds of the time. So pulling it back to why were we doing it, you know, you always want to right the wrongs of the prior design you did. Or are you wanting to right the issue of the moment that you just discovered last week?
Of course. This time it'll be perfect.
We'll make new. Let's go boldly forward making new problems, not redoing this.
Yeah.
So that was the environment. Just another speeds and feeds. Let's how can we connect the cables? So we asked, you know, Cisco, tell us about their current switches of the day. This client's a big company, so they have direct sales, and that's all a good thing. We'll hear more about it as we go through. But they brought in some product evangelists. In this case, was some distinguished engineers. They grabbed them off at the airport runway, drove them over. We got a 45-minute hello, acronym, and buy more. So, yeah, so we get this, and they start talking about ACI. So that sounds pretty cool. Can we buy it? At that point, no, we've just decided we're going to go down and start building this thing. We're going to call ACI, but it's going to be really good. So that's
cool.
So
this is 2013-ish then?
Yeah. Yeah. December, back end of 2013, beginning of 2014, mm-hmm. right in that period.
Okay.
So that's really cool, but we're here today to buy some stuff. I can't buy that stuff, so placeholder. I want to hear more about it. What can I buy today? And they said, well, we got this thing called DFA. So can I buy it? Yeah. So sure, let's keep talking. So then they start talking about leaf spine architectures as the newest, greatest thing. And I went, that's pretty cool. It's a clause architecture. I think we had those on phone switches back in the 50s. So.
Yep. Clause shows up all over the place.
Tell me more about this new great thing. If I cable it a specific way, I have.
Okay. When we started talking about leaf spine and they were calling them clause, guess what I read was a research paper from the 60s on clause architectures.
Yeah. It's got the hand-drawn matrix in it. Oh, yes. Yes, that's lovely.
Yes.
I worked at a place one time. We built a router, and we had a photonic switch, and they called it a rearrangeable clause architecture for the switch fabric. Yeah. These things have been around for a while. But that's it's good. You know, but a lot of people, I guess, these days haven't heard about it. So probably positives are marketing, that if you connect things equally, you don't get weird topologies and connectivity, but you connect them smart. You don't oversubscribe, or your edges are connected at lower speeds than your center stage. Things stand a chance of being better than the problem we had in our old design. So we said, I like this. Sounds good. Tell me about the DFA, the automation part. And then that's where the business value of the company and the operational piece matched up with what Cisco was able to sell at the point we were ready to buy. So it looks like a good...
Going back to that better, stronger, faster with fewer people.
Because we like the A. A sounded like automation. Mm. Automation sounds like better, faster, more better, quicker.
Yeah.
So let's keep going here. And dynamic, I mean, who wouldn't want that? Which is beautiful. This is the thinking, you know. This is a high level. Sometimes I call myself an architect who can swing a hammer. But this all sounds good. Let's keep talking.
Yeah.
And so that was the problem, building out a room. The business piece, we want to do things quicker. We want to automate them.
Was scale a big part of this? I mean, did you need to go, you know, wide over time maybe?
You know, it turns out that scale's a funny thing. It was big scale to this application in our network, but it would be tiny scale from like a Google or an Amazon type thing.
Sure.
So as we went through some of the, you know, go live pieces, design principles and risk and things you start thinking about scale kick in. But the reality, what I've found is everywhere I've been, the scale of the customer, it's as big as the customer has, and it's all massively critical to them. So I pull that back. What I really liked about the scale was they have a piece like, if you can dynamically create a structure and you can programmatically apply it, and then when you get it wrong, you go, oh, that was a brain dead idea. Let me back that out. let me fix it better. You can do it quickly and consistently if it's a scale of one switch or if it's a scale of 300. So we were definitely all in for that. And I think that's a great idea. Because one company could argue that 10 switches may not, you know, that could be a closet. But if that's all the company's business is running on that, that's massive scale for that company. Mm-hmm. That's all their business IT. So
now, as you were going through this, it sounds like you've only talked to Cisco. Did you at the time actually talk to anybody else that was building fabrics out there, Brocade or Juniper or some of the newer stuff like Cumulus or Plexi maybe?
Yes, we did talk to others at the time, and we continue to talk to all of these because the business part of this is when it's good business, it's competitive for everybody. And the reality is there's competitive features from all these providers. And as the retail purchaser of all these innovations, until you start looking seriously at two or more competitors, you're not going to get a reasonable price. You'll get a price, but it may not be as good a deal as you think.
You got to have them face off against one another and start driving the price down to get the best price.
Well, you need to at least look and try to do, as an engineer, I think you really need to do a spot-on job trying to make sure you're comparing apples to apples and features to features and equivalent speeds because to each other. So that's a challenge. And it takes a lot of diligence. And the sales process can get you a little diluted and off track to where you're no longer comparing equivalent things. So that's the work, right? But we did. In this case, we were, at that point, there's another part of the organization that was very big into Q Fabric from Juniper at the time. And then we were looking at Cisco. And so as we went through the process of speeds and feeds, we worked pretty hard to try to get a comparable build of materials from both solution sets and then presented the pricing from that back to the company to make a decision of which way they wanted to go. In this case, they chose Cisco's DFA for this deployment.
Yeah, QFabric is a pretty different product, too.
It is. And so that was part of the company's multi-vendor approach was Juniper had a certain piece of the business and the type of equipment that goes in, and Cisco had some of the others. So that was kind of the model that this company's working under. And as engineers, we tried pretty hard to make a comparable speed and feeds and feature type design. So in this case, it came down to some more operational choices because pricing got reasonable. We had a solution for both sides. And then it became the other part of decision making. You know, what kind of staff do we have? What kind of support do we think we'll get? What does it mean for monitoring of tools and all those kind of things? Do we have enough time to learn the other type of things? So,
now, of course, you don't want to get ripped off on price, but I've been in environments where the money wasn't really the biggest issue. You know, you need to do your due diligence and get a good quote, but the money was always going to be there. They're going to spend what they need to spend to get it. Was that the environment you were in, or were you really price sensitive?
That was a good way to put it. There's definitely price sensitive, and we took this as a pride within the just a couple of us in the group that would make the recommendation of one solution versus the other. And maybe you don't. Passion I try to put to it. I really want to make sure we compared the oversubscription ratio, the number of leaf switches we ended up with, and the amount of leaf to spine uplink speed. So it was very important to me that we can keep a consistent oversubscription ratio in comparing the two different type of technologies so that we would have a better equal response to, you know, to compare from.
So why would you buy an architecture which oversubscribes the leaf uplinks? So I think what you're referring to is quite often you can buy a 48-port 10-gig switch. So you've got 480-gig southbound. But the switches today typically only have 440-gig ports up. Is that correct? So you're running 160-gig ups with potentially 480-gig south. And so you're looking at a 4-to-1 oversubscription ratio. That's the summary of your
3-to-1, I think.
Let's say 40-80. Yeah, so we ended up with like a 3-to-1. We had a 48-port. Yeah. We bought Cisco's Nexus 5672s is what the top out, the leaf switch we're looking at here. And so they have, you're right, they have 6 40-gig uplinks. But we made a decision to do a VPC pair between two leafs.
Right.
And so we dedicated a couple of the 40-gig links for the VPC peer link and 4 uplinks.
Yes,
so,
which is that way of getting 6 40 gigs out of the 40 by 10s down. You take 8 by 10 gigs and turn them into 2 by 40s, and then you have 6 by 40s up. Is that what they were doing?
Well, we ended up leaving them at full 40 gig on the uplinks, and their ECMP, it's a layer 3 forwarding across the fabric path between the kind of getting down to the technology pieces.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I don't want to jump over. No, just sort of So one of the discussions I've had with companies is just don't buy switches that are oversubscribed. Or why is oversubscription a problem? You're not likely to run 400 gigs anyway, are you? Or like 160 gigs out of your servers, or are you?
Well, it's one of those things. It's bandwidth for dollars is why you if you have unlimited dollars and you could do no oversubscription. I was looking at a Plexi build the other day. You know, it's just kind of fun. You like sit there and go, I got a 0.67 under subscription, right? 0.67 to 1. That would be pretty cool. I like that number. So, why not that?
A contention-free backbone,
So, yeah. Sometimes it's 4.4 to or 8 to 1 because you don't have enough dollars to buy the gear you'd like to do the other.
Well, so I'm thinking back to back in the days, just to take this back and read it back, is in the days of 1 gig, we quite often had like 8 1 gig ports attached to a server, but none of them were actually firing at any point in time. Or, you know, like the data ports might have been firing, but the other ports were unused. So 8 to 1 was fine back in those days, but now we're actually down to servers run 210 gigs at most. But the servers themselves generally can't do more than a couple of gigs anyway. Like the applications won't generate that much traffic. Or did you test the apps to make that happen?
No, I mean, same argument was back in the ATM lane days. Why did we need that 155 megabit backbone? PCs are only connected at 10 meg half duplex, and they never run that. We looked at it. We saw an average. It was only doing 1 meg. You know, over a 5-10 minute average. Those same points have stayed true to today. The problem is, I don't know when they burst. So whatever is attached to that leaf edge, if it's a 1 meg, a 10 gig link, or a 25, 50 gig link, when the frame exiting that host into the leaf is serialized out the link, it goes at line rate. Those little microbursts.
Yeah. Never you get a microburst.
They never show up in your SNMP 5-minute average graph of whatever the MIB told you. Or somebody looked at it and said, well, on average, I only send 2 gig of traffic. Why would I need this 10 gig link?
Because for some amount of milliseconds, you filled the line with traffic. Just boom, out it went. Yeah.
What vendor gives you instrumentation and telemetry to look at microburst and buffers quick enough to... But the short of it is operationally, you come back, we're always chasing ghosts on performance. You know, something went burp at 2 in the morning yesterday. That's where you start from. And you're confounded because whatever your link speed is, it's idling right now when you look at it. So I kind of come back to your question, the oversubscription. It's bandwidth for dollars. Don't oversubscribe your core links. If you can't, don't. If you have to, do it the least possible amount. I don't think it's a good idea to connect edge host at the same speed as the maximum of your core links. They are statistical multiplexers, these routers, or layer 3 switches with buffers. So that's all works to help us. Let's just try to keep as little oversubscription as possible.
Yeah, I guess that's true. By the same token, I should always buy the fastest possible car, right?
Absolutely.
So you'll never know when you're going to need to drive at 300 miles per hour, so everybody should have a Ferrari just in case.
If you can afford it. But that's a starting tenet that's not PhD in science anything. It's more of a how do you spend Tom's dollars. You've got limited resources, and engineering is balancing of these pieces with some operational bias. We came from the point of we had built our FEXs with 1 gig, our most recent thing we're trying to update from. At the time that FEX network was built, 1 gig server connections were all the rage. That was the fastest we could get. So it was all about uplinks of 10 gig with 1 gig aggregation on there. That was a pretty smart thing. And it worked well until we started connecting servers at 10 gig onto this thing. We began to have problems then. So we were trying, at this point, this design, right the wrongs of the prior generation.
Well, let's take a moment in our show to thank our sponsor this week, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. It's a lot of content here. 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content. 50 hours are added each week. I've reviewed a lot of this video content. It is very good. It's first class. They've got a stage set, etc. You can get at these courses a whole lot of different ways. You can get them streamed live, and of course, on demand, to your Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, 4th-gen Apple TV, or even your PC, of course. And you can learn on the go with your mobile device if that's what you want to do. So lots of ways to get at the content library. If you're wondering what sort of courses are offered, it includes CompTIA Advanced Security Practitioner, Ethical Hacking, Virtualization, Cryptography, Metasploit, and more. And then new, they've added just in March 2016, CCNP Security Courses, Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE, and Microsoft System Center Configuration Manager. So with IT Pro TV, you're getting over 100 step-by-step virtual machine labs and Transcender practice exams too, by the way. That is a $109 value, and you get all of that for one low monthly subscription price. And if you don't like it, you can cancel. It is a no-hassle cancellation policy at IT Pro TV. And corporate group pricing is available if you like that. Clients include Harvard, MIT, UCSD, Stanford, and many more. Okay, so check out itpro.tv/weeklyshow to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer. Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code weeklyshow30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/weeklyshow and use the code weeklyshow30 and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account. Well, let's move ahead into Tom, you've made the decision now. It's, you decided after, you know, you looked at Juniper, you looked at Cisco, you tossed around a few other things, and, you know, all the decision points, you ended up with Cisco, calling it DFA at the time. And what did you have to do to get ready for that install?
Yeah, I love this. So from the time the project lifecycle kicks around, you hit the squirrely phase. That's, it's a design life cycle. That's right after the purchase order leaves the door until the equipment hits the loading dock. So moving fast, better, quicker. We got our purchase order out to the vendor. Project's done. Technology's picked. It's all a matter of technical wizardry now. We began to set in motion a series of challenging operational requirements. We have a winter period of the business where we kind of freeze. We don't do work in the back end of the year because of things. It's very common for lots of companies. Mm-hmm. So we're probably in the February, March, April timeframe, somewhere in the spring, early spring, when the purchase order leaves. We decide, look, we got to get this thing live in the July, August period.
And by live, were you standing up Greenfield where you were going to migrate data over to it, or what was the scenario?
Well, with DFA, yes, it was a Greenfield computer room, but it has, DFA has an interesting thing with the leaf spine. Where you connect a classical Ethernet edge, there's still a spanning tree interaction. A fabric has to be the root bridge. Well, we had an operating network, and we had to make an interconnect at some point. And we knew when we did, that we would have a spanning tree event. And it would be a change in this case. We needed to articulate there was going to be a change, and there'd be a small burp while that traffic converged. Because at that point, all the company's business is running on the legacy piece. And now we're going to connect the Greenfield piece where green and brown meet.
And again, that fabric was going to become the root of the spanning tree?
Has to. That's a technical requirement of this implementation. So we knew that there would be a point where we'd interconnect. And then we would begin the process of shuffling old virtual machines and hosts and things like that off of the legacy network and onto this new network. But it's an interconnect point, spanning tree burps, key kind of thing. We knew that would happen. So we order the equipment, set a timeline. Looks like we're going to be aggressive because this is a DFA. It's automated and dynamic. That sounds fast and quick.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful plan. All right, let's go forward. Make it happen. Put it on a Gantt chart, timeline it, project, you know, all that stuff. But the equipment has to take some time to be delivered before the hardware comes in. So we'll take that time to learn about provisioning and things like this.
What did we just buy? Let's figure it out.
All right. It's kind of new to us. And we bring in one of our Cisco experts who's going to help us guide through this implementation. He walks in, he sits down, he goes, "You guys got to be nuts. This code isn't even out yet."
Oh, wow. Okay. So this, I was speculating that this was early adopter stuff for you. It was really early adopter stuff then.
You know, a little bit, it gets fun. And emotional conversations and the dynamic energy goes up. You know, there's some fun. To, whiteboard discussions was like, what do you mean it's code's not out yet? Well, it will be when the equipment arrives. Code's coming with the switch.
We're totally writing it right now. It'll be fine.
You're here. We're cool. What's up?
Oh, man.
So, like Shrek, there's layers and layers and layers of beauty. So we kind of go through and, well, what does that mean? Well, you have a control plane. At that point, the CPOM, the central point of management, later became known as DCNM, specifically DFA for DCNM, which is a certain build of DCNM. So DCNM is an application that Cisco has from their MDS SAN switches, originally came out for that, later augmented, grew to manage some of the Nexus 7000, 5500, the LAN side. Mm-hmm. And at this point, they added in the DFA portion to manage the dynamic fabric automation. And there's an LDAP database in there that the switches talk to, and a power on auto provisioning piece that provisions the switches. And so had some new features that went in this build. That portion was coming out about the first customer release at the time. The code for the Nexus was on another path, and the NXOS was coming along. So our support guy was just kind of walked in, very good, pragmatic consultation. He said, y'all are crazy. Are you sure you want to be crazy? So it gets fun. Also, at this point, you never just work one project. We have a second data center that's being planned to grow this into for a, you know, it's got a story we're going to build on this. And was deploying a DWDM Metro Ethernet ring that was going to connect and provide the connections between the two fabrics. And so the other guy, you know, he's a smart guy. He goes, you know, that's not Ethernet. What do you mean that's not Ethernet? Well, DFA is fabric path.
Right. It's trill.
I said, yeah, I've heard that. Well, but it's not Ethernet. I'm like, okay, I'm missing your point. I'm a little slow here. Help me out. He goes, it's a different frame format, and that's not going to work across your DWDM system. So you get a little drama in there, a little, well, there's other options. It's true, it's fabric path frame.
So, I'd never quite twig to that because I haven't actually been. But running non-standard Ethernet or, you know, a customized version of Ethernet isn't going to work on a DWDM because the repeater's not going to be able to encode it.
Well, turns out if you're using an Ethernet framed transponder, which was part of that thing. So it was good. You know, we kind of go through and went, hey, here's a level of detail. It's pretty important. I think we'll use a different transponder, one that isn't going to look at the Ethernet frame. It's just going to pass the optical signal. We're good. Keep moving. But it's fun engineering. It can be a big deal to look at. So details are really something you want to focus on. And
dig into maybe before signing off on the PO.
Well, you know, you just kind of, yeah. You can have a lot of fun conversations about should you or shouldn't you, good or bad, you know.
So you got a new computer room staged. You've got, you managed to get fabric path between these two rooms over the DWDM ring. Rooms or data centers? Were they two different facilities?
You know, what is the difference between a data hall, a data room, a closet, or a data center?
Geographically, I'm guessing they were...
In our case, the metro part, they're about, one's in Fort Worth, Texas, the other's in Dallas, or it's 90 kilometers away, 70 okay. kilometers. Got a ring going in there, so... So a lot of people get in there and they get to worry about distance, right? And should you or shouldn't you do like a layer two extension between there or not? You know, what's your round trip time? You know, you get all kinds of things. You kind of drill into fun things about speed of light and distance and round trip times and protocols. But we kind of went through there. So we're basically building this new room, purchase orders in. We're building a Metro DWDM that's in flight. And we got a second fabric on the planning board. So there's always multiple things we're engineering. And we've got to stand up this DCNM. Well, we'd like high availability. Let's put that in.
So wait a minute. DCNM, you had to have DCNM to build this system. You can't do this without it?
You need everything orchestrated, centralized, SDN-ish, needs a central control plane, central mm-hmm. manager. In this case, DCNM is that central management system.
Okay, just so we're clear then, it wasn't even, yeah, and power on, auto provisioning of the switches and so on, you had to have DCNM for that. It wasn't even an option for you to do assembly line of switches, configure them, and then rack them up like you might have done back in the day. This is a whole new thing.
Yeah, and that's the part that I gravitate to. If I can build a switch config in one place and let it go out to the other switches, if it's one or 300, Wouldn't that be cool that if I make a boneheaded mistake and then I discover it, I can back it out and revert it, but everything is always running the configuration to the best of what we want it, and it's consistent and it's out there. That sounds good. And so you get those kind of things in this particular case with the DFA and DCNM application. It's the manager of managers, the manager of the fabric. And, oh, by the way, it needs to be out of band because you don't, where does it run? Well, it's an application that runs on a virtual machine, runs in our case, ESX host. Wait a minute, my ESX hosts are on the fabric. Wait a minute, if I'm managing the fabric, how do we do that?
And well, then you realize that the switches don't have out of band ports.
They do.
Yeah.
But now, you know, the design part is like another, oh, I really got to bolster up a real out of band. I can stop calling that D-Link switch my out of band switch. Maybe I need something a little bit more robust than that. So the design of the out-of-band management network for these fabrics is an engineering takeaway for anyone listening. Really focus in on that because there's going to be a lot of, I think, vendor mumble, oh, yeah, you just have it, or a lot of presumptive things that would just be there. It's critical.
You have to build this out-of-band network that you can rely on because it is how you manage these devices. So availability is important and security is an issue then. And
yes, you get into all of those things you should take into account. And it's not well articulated, I don't think, enough as it's like step one in the design. You get a whole host of those other things. And then who's ever fabric it is should be able to run autonomously for a while if it can't talk into there, could keep running. But you get a chicken and egg. In this case, DCNM had to be up first before I could do power on auto provisioning, right? The out-of-band network needs to be there after DCNM, between DCNM and the switches. So kind of an order of buildup that had to go on.
That's an interesting observation because I remember watching a presentation from Netflix and they were talking about how they built their operational platform. And one of the critical decisions that they made about making their as reliable as possible was they said that the operations platform or the orchestration or the automation or the management system had to be of a higher quality, more reliable, more stable than the actual delivery platform. Because the only way they would know if the delivery platform was broken was if the management system was better than it.
That's a good point.
And that really struck home with me as I've always cobbled together OOB networks out of leftovers and whatever. And we've been fine with that. You know, 10, 100, 1 gig, that's fine. A couple of 10 gig hubs, that'll do. Oh, look, I've got a spare 100 meg switch. I'll upgrade the OOB to something that's only a decade old.
Yes.
I recently did some work for a client who was running a type of layer 2 fabric, and it used the out-of-band ports to synchronize the fabric. So all the data exchange between the switches wasn't going in-band, that is, it wasn't going over the 10 gig and the 40 gig ports, it was going over the 100 meg ports. Those 100 meg ports, there was only one on every switch, and if anything went wrong with the 100 meg network, the whole fabric crashed. And if I remember my DCNM DFA design, that's exactly what happens with DFA. It starts to come apart if the out-of-band network stops working because it can't be updated. I don't know if it actually crashes completely and stops operating because it can't sync, but I think it does. It just doesn't work.
Well, I would not want to speak for the developers at Cisco because through the process of this, I've become good personal friends with, I think, all of them. And they work really hard.
That's not a feature. That's a bug.
Yeah.
Right? The fact that you have to become friends with the developers of this product is not a positive thing. That, to me, that's a sign that the product was – well, not that the company culture that produced the product has got serious flaws.
Well, I don't know, Greg. We've been all around that. We've had that philosophical good or bad thing a lot. And everybody's right from a perspective on that. Here's my take on it. The good part is if anyone is out there working and wants to get a feature request or pitch their case to a developer in Cisco, ain't going to happen. Their whole company has been built for a long time to separate the developers from the users so they can develop, I guess. But if you're an early adopter, you have a channel into that. And now, why are you having that discussion? Is because there's a problem, which could be a bad thing or a good thing. You got to come back, why are we doing it? So business value. If you know why you're doing it, you're going to take some of these learnings as a technician in here, as I'm now having a better chance to have a dialogue or get a feature request in, or my use case gets a faster way to be scrutinized. That's probably a good thing. And in our case, we found some bugs and some learnings, but we've also had some of our feedback show up now into some of the features. So I think that's a good thing.
I guess my point is that a product shouldn't come to market that is so defective that you have to communicate with the product developers to fix it. Let me come back to the car analogy because I've used it already with Ferrari. If you bought a Ferrari, the first model to come off the thing, do you expect to take it back to the garage every week so they can fix everything that's broken on it?
On a Ferrari, I might. No, I know what you're saying, though.
You paid $300,000 to get, you know, some sort of Ferrari car that's got flashy red paint. You don't expect to take it back every 7 days and get it fixed or updated or patched. And one of the things that's happened in IT generally, but in networking specifically, is we gladly take vendors giving us incomplete, unfinished, unfunctional, non-reliable, non-working products, pay top dollar for them, right? I bet you didn't pay cheap for DCNM and DFA, and then happily take all the pain of buying a second-rate product without actually saying, this is unacceptable, I want a refund, and I want the costs back of the time I wasted on your faulty product. I'm really bent out of shape around this problem. Mm-hmm. Is that not a fair position to take, or do you think it's fair that your company invested hundreds of thousands of dollars of your time into making this product, this faulty product, or less than perfect product to work? Is that fair?
I don't think so. It's sort of. I mean, both sides of it. In general, your statement I would agree with. But I think if we go back, why would the company invest the time and that they paid me and others to do this? Is what do we get out of it? And I think we got a competitive priced speeds and feeds fabric. And I think would be unfair if anyone tied said DFA didn't work, as it kind of sounded like, as it did. The cool thing is it did do its thing for us day one out of the bat. But we made a series of challenging deployment pieces that most probably wouldn't. We took a very aggressive deployment. From that, there was not time for a lot of the learnings that most companies would go through. So we took on the risk of learning and deployment and worked together with the vendor to, you know, kind of balance that. And it was early. But the cool thing is when we went live here, all the switches were consistent. We reprovisioned, you know, brand new. Yes, could we configure them in series individually like we've done before? You could. And I think there's a lot of work that can be done in that whole Hope process. But there is a consistent way to provision them. And that adds stability. If I'm not having to handcraft every switch, I'm going to have a better operating network. So having a scalable way to provision these things in mass is key. A virtual machine, in case, can be discovered and programmed. So one of the pieces that worked day one, and it's a key part of it, is we've all pictured a data center room. Now let's picture you go into that room 5 years later and 19 other people have configured things on and off throughout the years. The configuration in that switch is going to have a lot of interfaces that are with amber lights, some with green lights, some blinking, some cables connected that have dead lights. There's going to be pieces of static routes that go to nowhere. There's going to be static routes that override each other that don't make any sense. There's going to be access lists that aren't referenced in policy. There's all this stuff that's going to be there. When you go to upgrade that switch, you got to wade through a lot of work to figure out what's actually operating from what's just leftover errata that may have been mistakes or just decommed, and you don't know. With the DFA, every switch you go into at the moment is a byproduct. Everything configured in there is what's running right now. So probably more critical to me from an operational piece as a network guy is when a virtual machine or a VLAN subnet was on this switch and my server team unplugs it and moves it away, and it was the last MAC address ARP entry in that VLAN, it times out. There's a deconfiguration automatically. So as automatic as discovery and provisioning, so forwarding can occur in the data plane, there's this decommissioning so that at any point in time in my fabric, every switch that's running, what's in there is what's actually running right now, and not anything in there is what was running last year. I just think that's pretty cool and good. And that worked day one, and that was a key thing of the automation that I think is cool.
A couple of things here then. You know, one, you're arguing in favor of early adoption. You get access to developers. So from an operator user perspective, you get to communicate to them the good and the bad. Yeah. And if there is bad, you now have access to the people that can do the fixes for you, you know, and make it good. And so what you're saying is, although most of us instinctively go early adopter? No, thanks. You know, .0? No. Someone else can take care of that pain for me. I'll sit and wait until it's, you know, there's some new releases and bug fixes out. Then maybe I'll think about installing it. But you're saying it's, if you're willing to put the time in to get it going, it's not so bad. There's an element of de-risking there just because you have access to the right people.
I think so. That's a good point. It's a de-risking, or it's a mitigating piece. You have to go there together for it to work well. It's got to be good for your business, so they fund your time and the equipment. It has to deliver what it's intended to. You know, in this case, Cisco put a lot of time and effort in there. We're kind of basically doing their development, pilot deployments, and things of that nature. And it feeds back into the broader user community later on with, you know, things that we found. But it is easy to get distracted on those things. At the moment, you're going through there and you're going, what? Why did that work? Oh, yeah. Ethernet, not fab. Okay, so you go through those things, and I think it's always a balance point as you go through. Realize, why are we doing this, and what are we getting out of it? Okay, let's keep going. Next bug. Why do we, you keep checkpointing. But I think it's all in all, it's a very balanced thing if it works on all three planes. You personally, the vendor, and your business.
Going back to your two DCs, you've got one in Fort Worth and one in Dallas, and you've got DWDM between them. You figured out how to push trill frames across for Fabric Path. So are you therefore doing layer two extension between them, or do you just have a unified fabric for management purposes?
You know, as it turned around, we went through that little phase of thing. There's a role called border leaf on the fabric. You got the leaf to the host, you got the spine in the middle, and a role for a border leaf. And the border leaf speaks Ethernet in our case. So, and we carried them over transparent transponders. So we basically have border leaf edges on both fabrics doing Ethernet. And then we...
Oh, okay. I missed that part. Okay. Yeah.
So we do a lot of virtualization. So multi-tenancy within the fabrics called Oregon partitions on iOS and XOS, you call them VRF synonymous. So we do multiple VRFs for security segmentation or multi-tenancy type purposes. And then there's BGP routing. So they look like, you know, four routers crosshatched between the two fabrics, normal ECMP multipath.
So it is, you're not doing layer two extension then between the two?
I do for some special purpose pieces. I did that with an optical wavelength. So I wanted a layer two extension. So this is more like DCI interconnect design. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg kind of thing, too. So when I set up my fabric in the remote data center, I needed a DCNM to control the switches over there. So I did a layer two extension in a separate wavelength. So it's optically separate. Control plane is different. All of that is in a different realm, basically.
So minimizing shared fate, then.
Right. So the risk of that fate is just the VLAN that layer two extended for a special purpose. So then I do some things for storage, less storage replication. They would like to have their own bandwidth. There's things that go on there that need special consideration. So kind of design that with optical wavelengths first, get enough separation, get enough bandwidth, tie the switching devices on there. Then I go up to my data center, DCI, that's kind of my border leaf edges, and I do some more things with WAN. So I try to design that in my mind. If I had a fiber patch cable, how would I do it? Okay, well, my DWDM, there's a way to have a consistent bandwidth for dollars, and I have a virtual fiber patch cord, essentially.
Yeah, you're emulating what you'd have if you had a dedicated piece of glass, except you're doing it virtually now.
Yeah, so I start there. What would I do if it was all in the same rack? How would I connect things? And a lot of those principles, we made a business case for why DWDM made sense financially, so we could have lots of bandwidth, lots of separation, we could control our cost and have fault tolerance and all those things. We keep design principle and connect them up that way. Where I'd like to go, so that kind of basically takes us through two fabrics operating, does well. Where do we want to go next? So that's the host mobility, being able to have a VM show up on one fabric and arrive at the other fabric and not have to trombone for its first hop gateway. Getting host mobility across there would require like an OTV, which has some layer two extension just for that piece,
but you can block FHRP or you can block HSRP between the two sides, and you avoid that first hop traffic tromboning, like you said. Yeah. For example.
Yeah, so those are some of the ways we want to take and grow this over time.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks.
And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see. Well, let's take a minute, Tom, and talk about installation tips for DFA. So you went through the pain. You've got it installed. You were an early adopter. What for someone who's looking at whatever the current branding of this product is, if they're getting ready to install this thing, you got some bullet points you could take us through quickly?
Yeah, I think you'd do this. Start with your speeds and feeds and figure out your standards so that when you go to do your provisioning and what they call the POP process, our on-auto provisioning, you're able to know what you're going to put in so you can have your consistency for like emulated switch ID or VPC pairing. There's some things in there you need to know what you're going to do before you can have them automated. So start working on that. Prepare your out-of-band management. Think about how you're going to tie that physical management, they call it management zero, Ethernet on each switch. How are you going to pull those back together and how are they going to reach your DCNM? Continuing on that, high availability, or where will that virtual machine for DCNM run and what happens when it needs to be motion, or how many hosts will it go on? So designing and making that out-of-band network as fault-tolerant as possible. Then you want to go to making some decisions on your VLANs. They have a thing called DHCP. Some people may have heard about it.
It's a thing, yeah.
Turns out it's a thing in our network, too. And so there's some special considerations. Where is our DHCP server?
DHCP, doing power on order provisioning since 1975. Well,
I got your boot pee right here.
You know what? There's a little bit more to it. That's about the way it went. Yeah.
Fundamentally, every version of POAP still looks like what we used to do back in the late 80s with auto-booting terminal servers.
You could get your head wrapped around something so simple and basic we take can become quite comical and then real mountain. So like the power on auto provisioning needs to, you know, pope and broadcast and fight. So DCNM has a DHCP server for that function of the switches. Then you may have hosts that are connected to your leaf, and they want to do a DHCP request to get their IP. So somewhere in your network is probably an existing DHCP server. Where is that, and how does your IP helper statement get to it? That little piece is a little unique in the fabric, and you can source that helper request, the DHCP relay, from the management network, or you can source it from within the fabric within an orgtician BRF. So there's some design in there to kind of consider. There's a little bit more to it than you may. There's an option 82 value because it's kind of like more of a carrier-based VPN-assigned subnet. So option 82 scopes need to be understood on your DHCP server, wherever it is. so they can return back the right host address onto the fabric into the right org partition. Yeah, it turned out there was that we had a good, healthy dialogue, just kind of like we did.
This comes back to that outer band network really needs to be better almost than the main network, because without it, you're never going to have a main network.
And you may decide, well, okay, I thought I was only going to use the out of band network for SSH administration, SNMP, and the POAP process, but maybe I want my DHCP request and relays to come out of there. And if they do, how does that out of band then connect back into wherever your DHCP server may be? Mm-hmm. Or you may not choose not to do it that way, and then you got to design how do you get it in band within the fabric and over. So a lot more to it. So that I would take people to take that to heart and really look into that area of administering. Then you get down to your, what are you going to put in? Because the cool thing about Fabric, I hadn't talked about, just this morning before the call, somebody said, Tom, we'd like to take and make a whole set of servers for disaster recovery, have the same IP addresses, but keep them isolated. We've all heard this kind of request before, and sometimes it's a big problem. So I take a sip of coffee and smile and say, no problem. It takes me about 3 minutes. Because in my GUI, my webpage part of DFA, all I have to do is build a new org and partition. I'll call it DR or DR test and put a VLAN segment ID in there to keep it separate from the other segment IDs. That's the fabric path piece in there. I have to have a unique segment ID. And I'll put the same subnet. So that's the virtualization piece. And it's absolutely isolated. It's available across the fabric. I don't have to worry about which host is connected or which switch. I don't have to worry about any trunking of that segment ID or trunking of that VLAN across all the links.
Because they're separate segments, there's not a duplicate IP problem.
That's right. Virtualization, and it's about five objects in that GUI. And heck, if I was really smart, those are all REST API calls. I could have another orchestrator push that down automatically in there. And that's where I really get excited. Because having a REST API with these things to say, list the org, list the partition, okay, I don't have what I need. Right, set me a new org, set me a new partition, set me a VLAN object or a network object. Those now make it very automated, and it's available all across my fabric, available. And if the higher-level orchestrator is doing other things like building VMs and putting them on host, and I don't really care if it's vCenter from VMware or if it's a Red Hat CloudForms or any orchestrator up there, if we've administered that to happen, my network now is more, better, faster enabled. It's consistent. If operations go into a switch, what they see is what's running. They're not dealing with what was there last year and maybe not there now. It's all live right now. That's pretty cool. And that has been there. But you get in there, in those network objects, this is the next tier of where the DFA engineers should begin to think. There's forwarding behaviors. There's objects for like traditional forwarding. What the heck is that? There's options for EF. They have slightly different behaviors, and they're controlling the conversational learning underneath the switch or if the broadcast of traditional forwarding. So
now, again, you just said network objects. These are things that I'm seeing in DCNM?
Right, in DCNM, and that little GUI that you're going to provision a network object. You know, it's like any GUI. It's got a couple pull-downs. What you're pulling down are templates, right? So, and there's profiles are some of the terms that you will get familiar with. A profile for like a traditional forwarding would be a profile. You pull that in, and now your GUI asks you for really nuts and bolts why we get paid a lot. What's the IP subnet? What's the mask? What's the VLAN number and segment ID? Boom. That's it. You fill those couple forms in that you could have done that through a REST API if you're programmatic or if you're administering it through the GUI. Put in that information, apply. Now your object is locked and loaded in the database that's underneath there. And it's just sitting there waiting in DCNM. It's waiting for the switch to be presented with a MAC address and an IP or a virtual machine that wants to get on the forwarding plane. The switch sees this, has a quick dialogue through that out-of-band management network to DCNM, and it basically says, hey, this thing, we've never seen it before. It'd like to talk on the network. Here's its information it's told me about so far, like its MAC address and the KMN tagged with the VLAN ID. DFA looks in the in the database's object you've already point and clicked, and then it goes, hey, here's your config, configure this in your switch. The switch auto-configures things that we've seen before, like a VLAN, an SVI interface, and begins to build all that stuff automatically. Data plane forwarding begins to occur. Life's good. That machine just came on the network. The switch auto-configured itself for the SVI, the VLAN. Everything you need to it needs to know to operate in the data plane.
All because there was a network object pre-provisioned sitting in DCNM that the switch could say, look, I just found this packet just showed up on the wire. Got anything that matches it? Yes, I do. Here you go.
That's right. Now, let's say a week or 4 years later, that's the last remaining VM on that subnet, in that VLAN, on that switch. It goes away. There is a deconfiguring process that goes as well, and that those two together are, I think, really cool. And I think that allows the network to be stable and consistent within the data center to a way we haven't had before. And so that's the engineer, though, is going to start. You build your DCNM, you build your out-of-band network, you figure out your switch configs, you want your standards. Then you get into these objects, or these profiles. And there's a couple of key ones in there, like this is what you should spend your time on. Traditional forwarding profiles, EF profiles.
You say EF, and I'm thinking DSCP, express forwarding, no, that sort of a thing, or something else?
Oh, my Cisco buddies are going to kill me, because I think it's not expedited forwarding. It has to do with the conversational learning on the switch, which is all about the broadcast and discovery and redistribution of ARPs into the host routing that goes on within the fabric. So
now there's a few more notes that you'd put in here, installation tips. I'm just going to read through and see if you can comment on them. You know, one thing, a silent host, what is that and why do I care?
A couple hours before go live, we talked about these close delivery things and the classical Ethernet edge. We knew we were going to have a burp. So we're really locking down these network profiles and putting subnets, because we're taking what we had operating, how to represent it into the new greenfield portion. And there's a question pops up. Well, which VLANs do you have silent host on? I don't know. What's a silent host? So it turns out, in our case, vMotion VMK NICs would be a good case of a silent host. It just talks when it wants to. It tries to talk to its default gateway if it needs to, or ARPs out onto the network for whoever it wants to be emotioned to, and expects that the other guy hears it and they begin emotioning. And then they stop talking until forever, or the next time that they want to do something. That would be a silent host. A host that doesn't periodically ping its default gateway, doesn't periodically broadcast.
Yeah, it's on the wire, but there might not be anything in the ARP table for it, or in a MAC table for it, just because he doesn't talk that often.
Turns out a lot of really dumb things do that, like IDRAC interfaces on Dell servers, our APC PDU management devices we put on there. They kind of go dumb, and vMotion is another one. There's probably others in here. But the point is, if you're predicated on that automatic configuring and automatic deconfiguring, the deconfiguring is looking for conversations or packets going through there. But if you have a silent host, it stops talking for a while, and then your timeouts could occur. So the downside is, how do you make something that's silent start speaking? And that can vary by device type. So question comes back, which VLANs have your silent host? You know, my highly educated answer of, I don't know. What are they? That sounds bad. Oh, crap, we're going live here in about 12 hours. So let's pick that other profile. We went with that, took us down. Let's go make every VLAN a traditional forwarding profile. And so that allows broadcast and ARPs and things to continue across the fabric like they always have.
Less efficient, but less risky.
Not as efficient, less risky. I'll learn about that, and we'll fix that down there. We'll kick that can down the road for the next time. Mm. Because I don't know. How would I know what's what? You kind of have to want to learn that maybe one VLAN at a time as you go through and see.
Another thing you brought up was tracking MACs with more than four IPs mapped to them.
Yeah, so now we're about 4 hours to go live. we're looking at things. Yeah, we're getting prepped so we can know how do you know if things are working after you made a change. Maybe you ought to collect a little information ahead of time so you can compare it after. So we're kind of in that phase. I'm like, okay, this, here's all my ARPs, here's all my MACs, they're on these VLANs, and I got to count, I know which ones, and I'll be able to compare those later. When, wait a minute, what's this IP address that's got this MAC? And wait a minute, these 39 other IPs all have the same MAC. At that point, 4 was the magic number. So this was kind of a, to Greg's point, a benefit of going live with early code. And we caught it, went, what is that thing? Well, that's our F5 load balancer. Self, a lot of people have those things, I've heard. So F5s, yep. Self IPs, virtual IPs, you got lots of IP addresses, but you probably have one MAC for your, you know, the front end of what you're doing. That took us down to having to have a, build a layer, a different profile. We had to build a, I call them HSRP or Anycast kind of interfaces, but a special little config for the, in our case, it was a handful of VLANs that had that characteristic. And we had to account for those in a different manner.
Now, is that still a limitation within the fabric, or is that something that as new code has come out, it's been resolved?
Well, funny thing, new code came out and our issue got resolved.
So, uh-huh.
I don't know. Might ask Cisco what came in, but now you can, you have a knob now. You can turn it up. So in our next time we did a code upgrade, we had the feature that fixed the problem we had before. And that worked out really nicely. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure it was a part of our bug that we found. Or yeah, and it, and like, let's say things sound bad, but you get the story. At some point, a developer had to go, boy, would that be bad if I had more than 4 IPs represented by one MAC? And in this case, that was the number they chose at that point.
Who could possibly need more than 4? I think we're being generous here. Yeah. That's probably what the conversation was.
I think 30 is now the range. You can turn the knob up into that range. So,
okay, so let's move ahead to go live. You actually go live. You're gonna what? You've got a new config. You're gonna put into be a running config, and you've got code. You've got traffic going across this thing. What exactly is happening here?
Well, you know, I picked up in that CCIE lab back in 1997. You need to work smart. You need to work quick, but give yourself time to troubleshoot. So, we got a big corporate event, and we'd like to get this thing cut over. We know spanning tree is going to take 20 seconds. Let's get a 4-hour maintenance window. Give ourselves a lot of time to troubleshoot and confirm. And so we came up with a way. I had a lot of switches, though, to change on this because everything around that point, there's, I don't know, I had about 20 different switches, 16, 20 different things that all had to have unique configuration at once to make this interaction work. So we very quickly made that new config around the periphery of all these things happen. You wait 20 seconds, you wait 30 seconds, you smile, you start tapping your feet, you wait a minute, and then you start hearing things that you've heard before, like, well, that didn't happen in my lab. You start looking around the table and you see your coworkers with funny faces. And 4 hours later, you're in a mad scramble, you're backing out. What could possibly go wrong? And where's that out-of-band network kick in? So, you know, if you lose authentication, TACACS, AAA, you want to log into Switch because your session died for some mysterious reason, and you can't get back in because TACACS is on a virtual machine. Oh, your authentication goes to AD, yeah. Which is some other virtual machines.
Yeah, your change just hosed you in such a way that you can't get at what you need to get at now to undo what you did, and it's this, right, you just made a huge mess.
Where are we sitting? What room are we in? How does this wired connection get in back into where I need to be? Oh, you're on the wireless? How's the ape wireless LAN controller get it?
Yeah, you know, all this stuff you're talking about, I mean, the point here, you got to have a backup plan that you know is going to work.
And
you can't be, well, we'll just back out. It'll be easy. No, undoing any sort of a radical network change is always a really big deal, and so you've got to have thought it through ahead of time, which all the years that I built change controls and then and or rejected other people's change controls as they didn't have a backup plan. It's like, it's just a backup plan. You rejected it for that. Like, if you can't outline step for step exactly how you're going to undo what you did, we can't let this plan go through. You've got to be able to go backwards, and it's never that easy. You've got to think through what you've gotten to know enough about how to get back out of it.
And you've got to think about where are you going to be at? Where is your device going to be at in the network in relation to the things you're mucking with? And you better think about, are you on the wire? Are you presuming the wireless in the room you're in is going to still be functional? What about the wired network? What about authentication if you need to log in? Yeah, how many people have turned on AAA authentication and command accounting or command authorization? Suddenly, they you can't put the command in because...
No, authorization failed. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so those backout things need to be... I just can't reiterate your point to reiterate my point. For a young engineer, it can all go bad on you quick. And you don't want to be running around with a crash cart and getting into console devices. And it just... But you do want, if you have Nexus things, you want that checkpoint rollbacks really good. So,
well, okay. So, Tom, there's still a little bit more content I want to squeeze out of you. So quickly, let's conclude this by talking through, now that you've got DFA in production, what are the lessons that you've learned? You know, the biggest things that you would share here. I mean, one, we talked about early adopters is good, and you were able to defend that. What else have you picked up? Like, I'm curious, how well has automation actually worked out for you?
I think it's allowed our operations to have a consistently running network. The fabrics are not, will never be left with extraneous configs. And it allows us to build a network element. If like today's request, somebody wanted a new set VRF org partition built in about 5 minutes from accessing the GUI to point and click 3 or 4 objects in there. I think that's a blazing success, and it's going to add operational stability. I'm a big fan.
All right. Well, we've gone on for quite a while, and although it was edited out, dear listener, Tom had a wireless ISP hiccup that took us offline for about 10 minutes, so we're going to err on the side of caution and call the show right here. So, Tom Grisham, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us about this fabric installation experience. Now, are you social, Tom? Do you Twitter or do you blog or anything like that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, I listen to you guys every day, so that's my my social experience. You guys keep me on the straight and narrow.
Every day, huh? So what does the doctor say about that? Are you going to get better?
It's best if I've left in the data center.
Okay.
Coffee in the morning, beer in the evening, and keep me locked up in an environmentally controlled room. People can find me on LinkedIn under Tom Grisham as a profile. Or my website's tomgrisham.com, so I kind of keep the resume and online up there. But hopefully, through all my blather today, somebody gets a few pointers on operational pieces and...
Thanks a lot, Tom. We appreciate the time you put into this and the email exchange back and forth and contributing to the outline. This was Tom's show, pretty much everyone. So there are a couple links in the show notes at packetpushers.net that if you want to listen to a couple other shows that we've done about this product, you can hear those, show 207 and 233. And to everyone, thank you for listening to Packet Pushers today. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. And by the way, you can contribute to that community blog. Send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know who you are and that you got something to say. I mean, Greg and I have said for a long time, everybody's got at least one blog post in them. So if that's you, we'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can like us on Facebook, and please rate us on iTunes. We would appreciate that. You can also subscribe to our feeds and free newsletters at packetpushers.net/subscribe. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.